Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of Main Street on this Tuesday, we'll have several segments, including Our Living Lands. Across the country, indigenous communities have been impacted by natural resource extraction and displacement. Choctaw citizen and filmmaker Colleen Thurston explores those themes in her new documentary film, Drowned Land. Also, we have a This Week in Water segment focusing on a climate monitoring office in Hawaii that's closing, and also the impact of reduced weather balloon launches. And we also have a podcast we produce right here at Prairie Public. The title is When Kids and Books Collide. As we start Main Street today, we're highlighting the University of North Dakota's upcoming FenWorks North Dakota Esports State Tournament set for March 28th through the 29th. The event will bring together hundreds of high school competitors from across the state, and it's organized by FenWorks, a Grand Forks-based company that provides educational esports as a way for students to develop STEM and teamwork skills. The tournament is open to the public. It showcases the excitement and educational value of competitive gaming. And with me to discuss is Caleb Deshock. He is the CEO of FenWorks. Caleb, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me here. It's an honor to be here.
I'm a gray hair. I'm not a gamer, but I'm smart enough to realize that many, many teenagers, young adults, and others are gamers. Mm-hmm. Tell me how big e-gaming is.
Absolutely. You know, what we've seen is gaming has just become explosive in terms of the amount of people. All sorts of demographics and age groups are gaming. It's a way to stay connected, a way to make friends. And genuinely, when we look at the rise of gaming, at this point in 2025, gaming is ubiquitous with our young people. I think it's something close to 90% of all American kids are gamers. And so when we talk about the competition aspect to it, what you see with traditional sports and with other hobbies is people want to get together. They want to share that passion. They want to make friends in hobbies that are really important to them. So the state tournament that we're hosting is an opportunity for these K through 12 students to get together, hop on some of their favorite games, and compete against other schools across North Dakota to really show to themselves, to their communities, to their loved ones that, hey, I am doing incredible things. I am ready to showcase what I've built, what I've learned, what I've developed. And it means a lot to these young people to have the opportunity to do it. I genuinely wish I could have been on an esports team when I was in high school, just a little early to the craze, but our team is able to give back and give the next generation that experience. So that's pretty cool too.
So the stereotypical gamer is somebody who is just gaming at 2 or 3 a.m. Then they're too tired to go to school and maybe not looked at by folks in our generation as relevant. And I think that couldn't be farther from the truth. Help me explain that to our listeners.
Exactly. I think that stereotype has existed for quite some time. But now that we see varsity athletes in traditional sports are also gamers. By having esports programs, we're connecting these young people who are gamers to things that matter. So now their GPAs are part of being on the varsity team, just like traditional sports. We have coaches who are instructing these kids, look, you are not going to improve as a player or as an athlete if you're staying up till 2 a.m. in the morning, right? And so we have this opportunity to engage the next generation where they're at. And that is one of the most important things that we can do. For the longest time, we've thrown our hands in the air and we said, I just don't know how to reach these people. Well, the answer is simple. You meet them where they're at, and when you respect them, when you respect what they think matters, they're open to listening to your ideas, right? They're open to listening to, here is our nutrition plan and our exercise plan for our esports team. And so we have varsity teams across North Dakota and across all the states we're doing esports in that integrate health and well-being, social, emotional, and so much more into their programming. So that stereotype is thankfully going to the wayside. Modern gaming looks a lot different, and that is something that we can be proud of because it is far more responsible, it's far more connected, far more social than people realize who aren't gamers.
Before we get into the North Dakota Fenworks Esports State Tournament that will be held March 28th and 29th on the campus of the University of North Dakota, run down the list of colleges in the region that have competitive esport programs where students can compete on scholarship.
Yeah, for sure. So the University of North Dakota is the first partner that we want to talk about hosting this state tournament at their really region-leading facility in Grand Forks. We were able to host there last year as well and truly had an incredible experience because they have an esports facility that people are proud to compete in. And their varsity program has been explosive along with all of the financial aid and the prowess and the studying and the requirements that traditional sports have that that program has brought. So we're really proud to partner with the University of North Dakota. But as we expand our gaze outside of Grand Forks, we can see that a lot of colleges have adopted esports and are starting to get there. You know, Dickinson State has been a partner for many years, Minot State, NDSU just launched a facility, Bismarck State has had a facility. And so when we look at North Dakota, a lot of our public colleges are moving forward and launching esports programs because they are aware of something important, which is if they want to connect with the next generation, the future college-educated workers who are going to fuel our economy and discover research that is going to change the lives of the world, they need to make sure that they're providing an experience where people feel like they're connected to campus, and esports is the way to do that. In fact, in the United States, we have been behind on this trend for too long in turning video games into a healthy, productive tool. And now we're getting there. And so you've got marquee programs like UND's leading the way, and other state programs as well are doing a great job of connecting to young people.
All right. Fenworks has really quickly grown into a regional powerhouse. You were founded in 2020. What inspired the growth, and what is your organization? What is your vision? What do you do?
I remember being a student at the University of North Dakota and being a part of the initial launching of esports. So I get to brag that I was a, quote, D1 athlete at UND, and I get a lot of eye rolls when people realize that was for esports.
I'm at least smiling now, okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was an incredible experience to compete against other colleges in my game title. We got to go to a couple of in-person tournaments, and the experience that I had being able to have a similar experience to when I was a cross-country runner and competed in other activities in high school in North Dakota, and now I get to do that again at the University of North Dakota in my college career, that was a huge part of when the light bulb turned on in my mind to say, look, we need this to be happening in the K-12 space. And we were really blessed that K-12 educators, especially graduates of UND, started knocking on the door of our college esports program and saying, how do we do this in our high schools? And that's really where things kicked off. I quickly realized, okay, we need to start something. And now 4.5 years later, we have multiple state tournaments and we're helping young people succeed in states where our team grew up in. School districts that we were a part of are now doing esports. And so we get to give back to the next generation and provide something that matters and is meaningful to them. So what does the future look like? Continuing to do the incredible work that we do. We want more students, more schools to understand the incredible ability that STEM activities have to transform the lives of kids. We also do drone racing, right? So now we're doing this competitive event where students are racing drones against each other and learning about the UAS space. And so there's a lot more to be done, but currently we've got our focus in front of us on this esports and this drone racing, and that has already been impactful. Who knows what the future will hold?
So if I'm an administrator who's thinking about this, I'm thinking, holy smokes, I don't have the resources to do this. Or a parent who might understand that this might be a great thing for a team from my small school in North Dakota to compete with others. How big of a deal is it for a school to start a program?
You know, I think what school districts are beginning to realize is that the barrier to entry is not very high for a school district to launch a program. And so we have been successful in launching programs in the most rural schools, in the most rural states, in the biggest schools, in schools of all sorts of backgrounds. And so school districts are beginning to understand that these programs are a new way of engaging young people, of making them academically successful, socially successful, and to connect to the things that really matter as young people are graduating from our school system and moving either into the workforce, the armed services, or into college. And so you see the universities providing college scholarships, you're seeing the armed services launching esports teams as well. All of this tells us that esports is this really important social component, right? Just like pickleball has been, right? New activities launch all the time and they're ways of connecting communities, right? But what young people and what the next generation want to see is they want to see themselves represented. They want to see their activities, their priorities. And so esports is one of those. So if we want to be competitive communities that keep people engaged, this is a part of that. But the comments I get from administrators are really inspiring. Listening to educators say that launching an esports program is one of the easiest things that they've done. It's one of the most affordable programs and one of the most efficient programs in the entire school district. Those are the comments that tell us that we're on the right track in the work that we're doing to help communities be successful.
We are enjoying our conversation with Caleb DeShock. He's the CEO of Fenworks in Grand Forks. The group is working with the University of North Dakota for this coming weekend's Fenworks North Dakota Esports State Tournament that will be on the campus of the University of North Dakota. Caleb, how do you choose the specific esports games that you'll feature in the state championship? I mean, we're not playing Pong or now you know how old I am, right?
It's a classic. Yeah. Everyone knows.
Yeah. So what goes into that decision and how do teams prepare?
Yeah, the first priority is to make sure that the games are appropriate for the age that we're working with, right? So we're always making sure to select game titles that work for communities, that work for young people, that work in an academic setting. That's priority number one. The second priority then is to make sure that we're selecting fun, engaging, exciting game titles that make students go, I want to be a part of this and I want to be part of something greater than myself. I want to be a part of a team. And that's the last aspect. We love games that feature strategy, teamwork, leadership, communication skills, research, anything that makes students go beyond just the experience of gaming, but into those core educational skills that make them better people for our society. So that would be our third criteria. There are a lot of games that fit those criteria. And so that is how we pick our game titles. We also do a lot of surveying of educators and students to make sure that we're hitting our mark there. That's really important to us too, because although we may be gamers on our team, the trends can change so fast, it's important that you stay dialed in to the space.
Wondering what I'm going to see if I were to come and watch. This is open to the public. What Yes. am I going to see on the floor? Am I going to see a lot of workstations? How do students collaborate in real time while they're competing?
So what you're going to see is, you know, anywhere from 1 to 5 computer desktops lined up in a row and our teams seated together in voice chat on headsets, just like you might be at work or in other settings, communicating in real time to put in the best strategy using teamwork, leadership, deduction, and so much more to try and win their games, right? Just like you see on the basketball court, just like you see on the football team, you have shot callers, you have playmakers, you have folks on the offense, folks on the defense. There are so many parallels to our traditional sports, just in a different format, right? You're going to see a lot of confused parents. That's my favorite part. I have seen grandparents cheering and hooting and hollering when they see a goal made just for us to explain, hey, the other team scored. And they go, oh, we're learning. And so that experience is always phenomenal, because what really matters to these kids is, even if you don't understand what they're doing, what matters is you're showing up and saying, I care. I support you. I see you. And so there are a lot of parents that come to the state tournaments who realize that their kids are genuinely fantastic at the games that they're playing. And now with this ecosystem we've built, now those kids are getting college scholarship offers. They have head coaches of varsity teams at colleges, you know, saying, hey, I want to speak to the championship winning team at this event and tell them about my program and the scholarships that I'm offering. That, I think, has been an eye-opening experience for the community. So when people come to these events, they learn a lot and they begin to understand this really has shifted from those stereotypes we were talking about earlier.
is this a co-ed activity, I assume?
Yes,
and not only will you crown a team champion, are there individual awards as well that people are competing for?
Absolutely. So you're exactly right. It's a co-ed activity. Anyone can compete. And when we go to the event, you have some single player titles like chess. We've been able to really help accelerate the growth of chess programs. And that's a 1v1 title, right? One chess player versus one chess player, just like you traditionally see. Then you have your team titles, 2, 3, 4, 5 players on a team competing. And then we also do overall champions usually as well. So, you know, maybe in South Dakota, for example, Dakota Valley was our overall champion for South Dakota's state tournament. So you have this teamwork where every layer of the team is supporting each other. Even if you're not competing in the same game or in the same competition, you still have that team support. And then you have other people who might be broadcasting this back to their local communities. So we've seen lunchrooms full of students supporting their varsity team and watching them compete online at the state tournament. All of that is really exciting to us.
What is the prototypical gamer?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what we see is that gaming has become so ubiquitous, it is really hard to lock down, right? What does the new typical gamer look like? At the end of the day, we know that gamers have incredible problem-solving skills. Video games have some of the best onboarding or tutorials of all softwares. And so these young people are able to grasp exceptionally complex concepts really early on. We can see that some gamers who are engaged at a young age have exceptional reading skills and communication skills because they're doing a lot of communication through these game titles, whether that's reading or speaking. And so overall, this typical gamer has really shifted to, you know, yes, it's your varsity athlete. Yes, it is your traditionally successful science or math kid. Yes, it is fathers and mothers who want to stay connected to young people or just love gaming themselves. And so that typical gamer that we might have thought of 10 or 15 years ago has shifted into something that is really difficult to pin down. But we're seeing these very technologically literate people who understand how to use technology, who understand communication skills because of their connection to games. But it is critical that we, that as a community, we attach these games back to real world experiences because that's how we further that skill development. And I think that's a really important part of what we're doing.
Is there a money barrier that may be preventing some kids from taking advantage of these opportunities, do you think?
It's a great question. You know, when we look at it from a socioeconomic perspective, we know that we need to be setting up these centers, these areas, and these communities that allow all people to come in and play so that if there are students who are experiencing this, these disadvantages, they have a chance to connect and be like everybody else. One of the things that has happened, though, is the barrier to entry to get into gaming has continually gotten easier and easier and easier and more affordable. So we're seeing a lot less of those barriers, but we're still very sensitive and attuned to those. And that's why it's so important for school districts, community centers, things like YMCAs to start engaging with esports, because for those who can't afford it, or maybe they don't have a solid connection or other reasons, they have a place to go and game. And when we connect gaming to these centers, that is when we have the ability to connect gaming to other healthy activities as well, like exercise, like nutrition, like social emotional well-being and social relationships development. So I think it is critical that if we want to solve some of those challenges, we can continue to build these community centers like we have at these schools to push these programs forward.
Tell me from an organizational perspective, some of the unique challenges that you're going to be up against as you stage the Fenworks North Dakota Esports State Tournament March 28th and 29th at the University of North Dakota.
Yeah.
What are some of the large scale, I guess, challenges that are in front of you and how do you manage those?
Yeah, the first challenge is culture, right? The idea of these stereotypes of gamers is really ingrained in some of our population. It's why it is so important that we come and speak on channels like this, because that stereotype needs to go out the window. That is no longer accurate. But when people hold on to that stereotype, it makes it really difficult when you have a school district that's saying, hey, we have 30 kids here who are in no other activities in the school. They're not in band. They're not in football. They're not in speech and debate. They're not in student council, but they want to be a part of something. And esports and gaming has become something so much more than that stereotype, but we still have to do so much education, sometimes to administrators who say, this isn't a program that's good for kids. I've got thousands of students competing that I can tell you definitively are seeing increased academic success, social success, etc. But it takes time to break down those cultural barriers. So that is priority one, is for people to tune in, listen up, and say, hey, this is what the modern reality of gaming looks like. It is so much different. Come learn about it, because we can't keep letting culture be the reason we're not moving forward with programs that are literal game changers for these young people. When it comes to the state tournament, technology, technology, technology. We are interacting with so many different pieces of technology, so many different softwares, so much hardware, that it's critical that our team is up on top of all of it, because any one thing could go wrong and you have to triage a lot of different areas where, why did this not work? Why did this break down? Why did this shut off? So technology is always going to be one of our biggest challenges, because I don't think there is an event that uses as much technology as this esports event, while having hundreds of competitors, hundreds to even thousands of spectators. It keeps us on our toes, but we wouldn't do it if we didn't love it. So
how can I watch this?
So we do have some links available. We usually stream this content on YouTube and on Twitch. And so viewers can tune in. They can go to our Twitch channel, and our website is the best place to go, which is fenworks.com. And from there, you can find information on the North Dakota State Tournament to tune in.
I know that this particular competition doesn't involve drone racing, but as we start to wrap things up, Caleb, to me, that looks so cool. It looks so cool that I've seen on television. Are there competitions now springing up in our region? And Yes. Where are they? How are they managed?
Yes. So just like esports, drone racing is one of the next big things. How do we use technology? How do we connect young people? And how do we make learning something that's actually fun, right? And so in North Dakota, we are one of the epicenters of drone activity, not just in the nation, but in the world. We have so much pride in drones, with Grand Sky, the Air Force bases in Grand Forks and Minot, Grand Farm. North Dakota is the epicenter of this activity. So at Fenworks, we do the same thing we do with esports. We set up weekly competitions culminating in a regional tournament this year held down at NDSU in Fargo. And so these drone racing competitions are an incredible way to connect with athletes, just like we're seeing with esports. And now you have kids whizzing drones by at fast paces, learning how to fly these things, learning about the industry. We've got industry partners talking about careers. Our armed service partners and our higher ed partners are there. That drone racing program has been something truly exceptional, truly exceptional. So drone racing is here as well. Stay tuned. I have a feeling we could talk another half hour about drone racing on its own, and maybe we need to do that in April. So absolutely love what we're seeing on the drone front.
Looking ahead, what future initiatives or expansion do you see for Fenworks? And have you planned, I guess, to develop further your esports or related programs beyond North Dakota? I really emphasize, you're not just a North Dakota operation anymore.
Agreed. Yes, yes. It is really important for us to figure out, okay, are we doing things right? Well, we checked that box off years ago. So now our next step is to say, how can we take this to more people? So our first priority always is to get more school districts on board to one of the fastest growing activities in the United States. But now we're also doing our programming in South Dakota, Minnesota, and Wyoming as well, running state tournaments, having weekly competitions, training educators, helping students be successful in their weekly matches, and holding coaching clinics like you would have for other sports. There is a lot going on to make our schools and our communities successful. And so for us, our priority is the folks that we're already working with. That's always priority number one. And then from there, we want to grow the program so more people have a great experience like everyone else is having. So we have a lot more work to do in North Dakota alone. We have dozens more school districts that have other varsity high school activities that don't have esports yet. And I think the day you'll know we've done it all is when every middle school and every high school that has varsity programming has an esports team. That's how you'll know esports is where it's meant to be. That's what our young people think. And it's just a matter of time at this point.
My guest has been Caleb DeShock. He's the CEO of Fenworks in Grand Forks. We've been discussing the University of North Dakota's upcoming Fenworks North Dakota Esports State Tournament. That's set for March 28th and 29th. And it's hosted, of course, by the University of North Dakota. The event will bring together hundreds of high school competitors from across the state, and it's organized by Fenworks. They're a Grand Forks-based tech company. Congratulations, Caleb, to you and your team. I hope things go very, very well.
Thank you. We're very excited for it. We hope to see lots of folks there, and we're always excited to lead the pack, so thanks.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. There's still a lot to come on Main Street today, including segments from Our Living Lands, This Week in Water, and from a podcast we produce right here at Prairie Public called In Session. This week's segment is titled When Kids and Books Collide. That's all ahead on Main Street right after this.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new environmental documentary premiered in select theaters on March 23rd. KOSU reporter Sarah Lisi spoke to Choctaw citizen and filmmaker Colleen Thurston about her new film, Drowned Land, and the continued fight to safeguard Oklahoma's Kiamishi River.
The film, Drowned Land, is personal for Colleen Thurston. In it, she explores her family's history, the homelands of the Choctaw people, and the land they now occupy in southeast Oklahoma. So our interview begins there, understanding how she gave herself permission to tell a story so close to home.
I really was interested in exploring the lakes in Oklahoma, and I thought it was interesting that my grandfather had such a hand in building and developing the lakes in Oklahoma. And then once I came down to the Sardis Lake area, and the more I talked to people, the more they said, okay, but the real story is the Kiamishi River and what's going on with the Kiamishi River. I listened to them and I let the story and the community lead me. I kind of gave up control in a lot of ways. Like I said, I feel like I'm kind of a conduit for the river and for the community.
Native American storytellers often talk about being vessels for indigenous stories and environmental issues. Thurston called that work a responsibility.
We talk about being stewards of the land, but we're very much stewards of stories too. You can tell your own personal story, but once it becomes a community story, once it's a collective story, or even if it's a story of the land, then we are just conduits, or we are entrusted with the responsibility of carrying on those stories, and especially for entities that don't necessarily speak our language, right? Like rivers or like trees or mountains or whatever it is. Additionally, we really want to prop up the idea of the rights of nature movement, to prop up this movement of recognizing that rivers, that trees, that mountains, whatever it may be, they are sentient and they can be recognized as such, and their rights can be recognized and their rights can be protected. If a tribe, whether it's Choctaw, Chickasaw, or any tribe, declared law that legally a river was protected, that would absolutely change that interaction between the state government, the state of Oklahoma, and a tribal nation.
The film asks its audience to consider where their water supply comes from, while fostering a sense of appreciation for the land.
I think growing up in Oklahoma, this was always a place where if you wanted to be anyone, if you wanted to do anything, then you should leave. That was kind of the message that I got. And I moved back full-time here when I was 30, and that became a message that I wanted to change. Like, you don't have to leave here. why did we internalize that this place is not worth it? I hope that this film can maybe change that perspective of Oklahoma and just bringing the film to communities that maybe have been affected in similar ways or maybe have also been kind of told, like, your place isn't worth it. You're not worth it. You should leave. So we want to do a reservation tour, and hopefully, you know, people can see themselves in this film. We've submitted to several festivals that we're excited about, and we'll do probably a year, probably a little more than a year of a festival run, and then the film will be on public television. It'll be on PBS somewhere towards the end of 2025 or 2026. We also want to do educational screenings and, like I said, community screenings for anyone that feels like this would benefit their community.
Drowned Land premiered on March 23rd in Santa Fe, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. For more information, visit drownedland.com. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Bird Note. As twilight deepens along a dry desert stream bed, a tiny owl peers out from a hole in a sycamore tree. It's an elf owl, the smallest species of owl in the world. Standing less than 6 inches tall, with gray feathers and big yellow eyes, the elf owl weighs less than an ounce and a half, a bit less than a golf ball. And they're determined predators. Flying out from its tree cavity at dusk, the elf owl hunts beetles, crickets, and spiders, plus the odd lizard or mouse. Larger prey, such as scorpions, with the stingers carefully removed, may end up cached in the nest for later dining. Elf owls live in woodlands and desert cactus habitats in northwest Mexico and along the border of the southwest U.S. They often nest in woodpecker holes in tall saguaro cactus. They depart their breeding range by October to central and southern Mexico, where insects are more available in winter. But spring comes early to the desert, and the minuscule owls return by late February or March, ready to begin their breeding season. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Bursting a weather forecaster's balloon. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It was learned last week that the Trump administration plans to close an office in Hawaii that helps measure climate change.
Scientists at the Global Monitoring Laboratory in Hilo gather daily carbon dioxide measurements from the Mauna Loa Observatory on top of the volcano about 35 miles from their office. The data have shown that CO2 levels are rising faster than ever.
The office, but not the observatory, which is owned by NOAA, is on the list of facilities whose leases are set to be terminated by DOGE, the cost-cutting effort led by Elon Musk.
The lab has an annual lease of around $164,000 and is run by a small staff of 8 people who manage and maintain instruments. It's unknown if they could continue their work without an office.
DOGE cuts have also led to fewer weather balloon launches by the National Weather Service, which provide information for forecasters.
In the past, the balloons have been released twice a day from around 100 locations, but that's been reduced to once a day in some places after hundreds of employees have either left or been fired.
The balloons gather information that cannot be retrieved in any other way as they go 100,000 feet into the atmosphere.
Launches will be stopped in Omaha, Nebraska and Rapid City, South Dakota, and cut down to once a day in Grand Junction, Colorado and Green Bay, Wisconsin, among other locations.
the U.S. has rejected a request by Mexico for water from the Colorado River to help the city of Tijuana.
Tijuana's metropolitan area has more than 5 million people. It's a manufacturing hub and depends on the Colorado River for about 90% of its water, but suffers from leaky infrastructure and is now in drought.
The State Department said the denial was because Mexico has not lived up to its obligations to deliver water to the U.S. under a 1944 treaty that benefits farmers in the Rio Grande Valley. Mexico has asked for the special delivery to Tijuana outside the framework of that agreement.
Climate change, population growth, and parched farmlands have made it difficult for Mexico to comply with its obligations, according to its government.
It's the first time the U.S. has refused to help drought-stricken Tijuana.
March 21st was the first World Day for Glaciers, meant to raise awareness about the critical role these massive frozen rivers of snow and ice play in our world.
Rising global temperatures are causing glaciers to retreat rapidly, with 5 out of the past 6 years having the largest loss on record, according to the World Meteorological Organization. Sounding the alarm, they say much of what used to be called eternal ice will not survive the 21st century.
Mountains and glaciers, the water towers of the world, supply up to 70% of global fresh water. They also influence atmospheric circulation, shaping weather and precipitation, so their disappearance, and in many cases irreversible retreat, will mean increased water scarcity, rising sea levels, and a higher likelihood of natural disasters like floods and landslides.
The World Glacier Monitoring Service estimates that since 1975, glaciers, not including the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, have lost the equivalent of an ice block the size of Germany, 25 meters thick.
The largest annual loss happened in Scandinavia and North Asia, but a study published last month found that at present melt rates, many glaciers in Western Canada, the U.S., Central Europe, and New Zealand will disappear by century's end.
Part of the publicity for the first World Day for Glaciers included naming the Glacier of the Year, which is the South Cascade Glacier in Washington State. The designation is meant to highlight the beauty of glaciers and to honor the glaciologists who have been monitoring them for decades.
And finally, African penguins are an endangered species that live off the coasts of South Africa and Namibia. They're threatened by depleted food sources from overfishing, climate change, and pollution.
The animals can live up to 15 years, but in the wild it's less likely because slowing down in old age can mean being eaten by a shark.
But some lucky ducks, or penguins rather, who live at the New England Aquarium in Boston will reach a ripe old age because the facility has set up an old folks' home for penguins, or perhaps an old flocks home?
Last year, the Penguins and Pinnipeds Department designated one island in their aquarium habitat specifically for the needs of older birds.
For the geriatric penguins, this means special treatment like being fed fish injected with water to promote kidney health, daily eye drops for cataracts, foot ointments to prevent infections, and even receiving acupuncture and physical therapy.
The Tranquil Island enclosure has some of the same accoutrements of human-assisted living facilities, such as peace and quiet, as well as ramps and flat areas for birds with mobility issues.
Some of the oldest retirees are Harlequin, who's 32, and Durbin, who's 31. So the aquarium seems to be doing a good job at putting old age on ice.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
You're listening to In Session, Prairie Public's weekly deep dive into North Dakota's 69th legislative session.
I'm Eric Etheridge, and Alquist is with me, and we've looked at some tough topics as we tape our 11th episode now. But this week, we're looking at a debate that cropped up last session and has dug fault lines throughout our nation's history.
It's about books and kids.
I stand before you today to present the amended version of Senate Bill 2307, a necessary and measured step in protecting minors from the exposure to obscene and sexually explicit materials in schools and libraries.
That's Senator Boehm.
This bill didn't come out of nowhere. Something happened, I presume.
A parent, Sarah Plantine, testified about her experience.
In August, my children came home from school at Sargent Central Public School in Foreman and told me the school had a poster displaying a new book series. This new book series is written below a middle school reading level and is a cartoon book that is said to be for grades 9 through 12. The summaries on booklooks.org state it contains self-harm, gender ideologies, explicit sexual activities, alcohol use by minors, profanity, derogative terms, and alternative sexualities. It was on a front display when you walked into the library and was accessible to all grades, pre-K through 12.
So the process she's describing and that she followed didn't end up with the result that she wanted. And so in particular, her experience, again, as she described it, resulted in derision.
I spent days driving around our school district and talking to patrons. The community was shocked, upset, and disappointed. I can't tell you the number of people that commented, "Common sense is gone." I had multiple people start to cry when I showed them the books. Some looked and instantly had to close the book because they just couldn't handle what I was showing them. They agreed showing cartoon characters having anal and oral sex was not something they wanted their tax dollars spent on.
This was a painful issue for this mom and for the town. I took a look at the website of the school district, Sargent Central Public School District in Foreman, North Dakota. It's everything you would expect. I mean, the school district's motto is Together is Central.
Yeah, it sounds like a very tight community. And what was the book, I'm curious, that generated so much concern for Sarah Plantine?
It's a series called Heartstoppers. It says it's for ages 13 and older, and it's a British graphic novel series about two teenage boys falling in love.
All right, so who spoke in opposition to that bill?
So this is interesting watching the hearing from February. It was equally split between those who supported the bill, who were concerned about the effect exposure to sexually graphic material could have on young people, to people who opposed it. And of course, librarians, who are in the business of creating access to books, spoke out against the bill.
This bill doesn't protect students. It limits their access to knowledge, diverse perspectives, and historical realities.
That's Dr. Chris Larson, superintendent of Milner Public Schools. He talked about books that would be affected by this law.
A Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. A firsthand account of the Holocaust that includes passages about puberty and self-discovery. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. A classic novel that explores racial injustice and contains discussions of sexual violence.
Yeah, classics. And there are a lot of books that tackle difficult subjects. So, Aon, this bill came up last session, and then Governor Burgum vetoed it. But he did sign a bill that added restrictions to what public libraries could place. What was the difference there?
The penalty. Governor Burgum vetoed the bill that would penalize someone with a Class B misdemeanor if they willfully displayed, quote-unquote, objectionable materials frequented by minors. So that included newsstands, businesses.
Like bookstores, right?
Yeah.
So what happens next with SB 2307?
So it crossed over into the House, where it got a hearing last week, and specifically House appropriations.
Yeah, so if it's appropriations, there's got to be money involved.
That's right. So in order to comply with the bill, libraries would need over $1 million to update Odin. That's the online search engine libraries use. It would have to be reconfigured to filter out, again, the quote-unquote objectionable materials.
And the penalty, is that still in the bill?
The state's attorney could prosecute violators. So there's very much the threat of a penalty in this version of the bill. School and public libraries could see their funding withheld if they do not comply.
Let us start with the first number in our weekly three numbers wrap-up.
Related to the lawsuit case that wrapped up last week, $660 million Energy Transfer, that's the company that built the Dakota Access Pipeline, was awarded over $660 million in a case against Greenpeace. Greenpeace called it a slap suit designed to intimidate activists. So my next number is one, as in one count of traveling to have sex with a minor, which is what former state senator Ray Holmberg will be sentenced for this week. Prosecutor Jennifer Poole alleged a slew of allegations against Holmberg last week that included testimony from witnesses who said Holmberg used his power in order to have sex with them.
And my number, Anne, is 5, as in 5 years since the start of the COVID pandemic. Remember when? I know a lot of us are probably trying to erase that memory, but it's there. The beginning of things like Zoom meetings, which are still with us, lockdowns, which are not, deep divisions over vaccines, which is still there. And, another good thing that's there, a deepening appreciation for pets and national parks. A lot of us are still going outdoors as a result. But let us not forget that lots of North Dakotans passed away from COVID, and our kids are still struggling to catch up from those said lockdowns when they were out of the physical schools here in North Dakota. But Ann, I'm here, you're here, we are all here, and man, am I grateful.
That's right.
Well, thank you for listening to In Session. We appreciate you. Our production wizard, Tay Calloway, is Prairie Public's radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager. And Leah Peterson is Prairie Public's digital communications specialist. We appreciate those guys, too. Thank you. I'm Eric Deatherage.
I'm Ann Alkus. We'll see you next week.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 25th. In 1861, Iowa Senator James W. Grimes proposed a medal specifically for the Navy, and President Lincoln signed the legislation creating it. In 1862, Massachusetts Senator Henry Wilson introduced a bill to create a similar medal for the Army, which President Lincoln also signed into law. On this date, in 1863, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton awarded the first medals of honor to the 6 surviving members of Anderson's Raiders. Since then, out of all the millions of Americans who have served, only 3,052 service members have been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. 17 Medal of Honor recipients are from North Dakota. The first recipients from the state served in the Spanish-American War. Lieutenant Colonel Teddy Roosevelt, who cherished his association with North Dakota, chose it as the place to enlist. Lesser-known North Dakota recipients from that war include Colonel Benjamin Hardaway of Fort Totten and Joseph Carter from Fargo. When the Spanish-American War ended with a treaty, North Dakota troops in the Philippines unexpectedly found themselves involved in the Philippine-American War. 11 members of Young Scouts were awarded the Medal of Honor for their heroic actions in that conflict. On one occasion, 12 Scouts routed a force of 300 enemy soldiers. In another action, 21 Scouts drove 600 enemy soldiers into a full retreat. North Dakota servicemen have continued the state's tradition of heroism. Master Sergeant Woodrow Keeble served with the 164th North Dakota during World War II. The unit was reactivated for the Korean War, where Keeble was awarded the Medal of Honor for single-handedly destroying 3 enemy positions. First Lieutenant Lauren Hagen from Fargo led an Army reconnaissance team in Vietnam. He was killed while attempting to rescue his wounded men. Most recently, Staff Sergeant Clinton Romisha from Minot was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions in Afghanistan. President George W. Bush observed that the Medal of Honor epitomizes the very best of what America stands for and honors the gallant individuals who have received it. North Dakotans can be proud of the state's long history of service in defense of the United States. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me, and so is knowing the scoop. like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer, that kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
And that's it for this Tuesday's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, it's our monthly Philosophical Currents segment with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. And we'll explore a tough topic, the profound and ethical philosophical questions raised by a Quebec woman diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, who's become a powerful advocate for the right to make advance requests for medically assisted death. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.